Don't pay retail for your diamond engagement ring or gift. Come to cleanorigin.com. Founded by a leading family in the diamond industry for more than a century, we're experts in lab-grown diamonds because that's all we do. Clean Origin, the only diamond jewelers who give you a 100-day, no-questions-asked return on your purchase. Head to cleanorigin.com or one of our retail stores and mention code RADIO10 for 10% off your purchase. That's cleanorigin.com, code RADIO10.
Over the past half a century, we've been experiencing the same hurricanes, blizzards, and storms. Our changing climate may have altered how these weather phenomena act, and in turn, the technology we use to research and forecast these events have changed as well. From a local National Weather Service office to the Storm Prediction Center and the Weather Prediction Center, today's guest has seen decades of change across these institutions and has made them all greater along the way. We're talking to Greg Carbon, Chief of Forecast Operations at the Weather Prediction Center, ahead of his well-deserved retirement. Greg, thank you for joining us on the Weather Geeks podcast.
Thank you, Marshall. Welcome. I'm glad to be here, and we'll have a great chat today.
Yeah, it's amazing. And, you know, shout out to my colleagues at the Weather Channel and shout out to Greg, because, you know, we're bringing you some new and exciting things at the podcast, but Greg is our guinea pig today, walking through some of those technological challenges. But the podcast will be that much more awesome because of Greg Carbon's patience with us today. Now, Greg, I start off every podcast with the question that I ask every guest: how'd you become a weather geek?
So my intro into weather is a combination of experiencing phenomenal snowfall, but also a mentor in my family who took weather records and kind of brought me along and showed me how you could do meteorology with very few scientific tools. You know, I was interested in biology. I was interested in chemistry. But, you know, those things require certain tools. You want a microscope or a chemistry set. Meteorology has a very low entry point as far as what tools you need: a thermometer and a rain gauge and a notebook, and you can get started as a meteorologist. And so through some mentorship and then watching snowstorms in northern New England, I became passionate about meteorology as a science to pursue.
So at this point, let me just give you a bit of background on Greg's career, and then I'm going to ask him for his own take on it. So Greg's currently the Chief of Forecast Operations at the Weather Prediction Center. You may know that as WPC, and he's been in that role since 2016. Previously, he was a Warning Coordination Meteorologist, or WCM, at the Storm Prediction Center, and has also worked with the National Weather Service and private sector. He has graduate coursework at the University of Oklahoma and a bachelor's degree in meteorology from Linden State College. So I just laid all of that out for you, but many of our Weather Geeks listeners may not understand the full scope of the ecosystem that is the National Weather Service. So Greg, tell us a little bit about sort of some of your early sort of career paths and then how it evolved to you arriving at WPC.
So, I'm very lucky, very fortunate to have come across opportunities. I think at a very early stage, I knew that I wanted to pursue operational meteorology with a bit of research as well. Coming from that early science passion background, I wanted to be engaged in forecasting day-to-day weather, but also understanding the science and try to pursue ways to advance it. When I first graduated from Linden State College with an undergraduate degree, very, very much about the same time as Jim Cantore, we were classmates.
I was going to mention that. I thought Jim was there around the time.
Yeah, we were. And I think, you know, we both shared this similar passion for weather and understanding weather and forecasting. And Jim pursued the broadcast meteorology path, and I pursued sort of the operations forecast path. I knew I wanted a position with the National Weather Service. However, at the time, this was mid-80s, there weren't a lot of opportunities with the U.S. government. There was not a lot of hiring going on at that time. And so I ended up taking a position with a private sector company that's still in business and still have some folks, meteorologists working there, Fleet Weather in Southeast New York. Mm-hmm. So that's sort of where I got my start, a little bit of broadcasting too, mostly radio work, and work on, we did a lot of different forecasting for ships and ports and, you know, trying to short fuse warnings, for port operations. And that was my start. I then jumped from that into a contract position at the airport up in Montpelier, Vermont, doing weather observations for a while and some consulting work with power companies up there. And then the Weather Service started hiring. They opened up and decided to put in for a position and was hired on in Charlotte, North Carolina. So the trip from Vermont to North Carolina was brought the whole family, two cars, two cats, two kids, and got my start with the National Weather Service in Charlotte. And I was in heaven. That's where I wanted to be. I wanted to be working operations. They were located at the airport. They had a 1974 C-band radar for local warning there. And it was wonderful. It was just a really great experience learning the, you know, ropes as far as the entry-level position with the Weather Service. I really enjoyed the climate down there and then the timing of thunderstorm development. Every day, you'd have the thunderstorms pop up over the Appalachian Mountains and they would drift into the Piedmont. And it could get pretty busy during the spring and summer months there. Of course, you had a major airport, so airport operations were very keen on weather and changing conditions. And had an interesting boss. He was a hard boss, but he was fair, and he ran a tight ship there. And that was my start. Went from there to Wilmington, North Carolina, on the coast. Really enjoyed it there as well. Fascinating weather right there with the Gulf Stream offshore and the topography of the East Coast. And I always thought of Wilmington as sort of being the, you know, the birthing grounds of the East Coast cyclones that I grew up with, watching up in northern New England. That's where they got their start. And it was fascinating to learn about the dynamics and the details of the meteorology with regard to the, you know, genesis of these storm systems. Saw really interesting weather in Wilmington. I wasn't there very long when an opening came up in Norman, Oklahoma. And they were moving the Severe Storms Prediction Center from Kansas City to Norman to be co-located with the University of Oklahoma and the National Severe Storms Laboratory. And my boss in Wilmington had worked for the Severe Storms Lab in Kansas City. And he said, if you want to go to Oklahoma, I can certainly, you know, help you get there. You've been a great asset for the office here in Wilmington. But I understand, you know, you want to move forward in your career. This might be a good opportunity. And that was sort of the last real big move up until 7 years ago. So I spent 20 years in Oklahoma at the Storm Prediction Center, essentially working my way up through the ranks and learning the ropes. And never in my wildest dreams did I think I would go from loving snowstorms to kind of being a spokesperson for NOAA. With regard to severe storm forecasting and tornado forecasting. That was a wonderful, wonderful experience. And 20 years of work there, raised the family there. Once the kids were out, the opportunity came to come back east. And so it took the job in 2016. Again, kind of looking for opportunities and looking for challenges, and came back to the Weather Prediction Center in 2016 as the operations branch chief, and have been here since then. So it's been a wonderful career.
Talking with Greg Carbon of National Weather Service, I'm Dr. Marshall Shepard. Greg, let's set the stage for our listeners and our viewers on the difference between what the SPC does and what WPC does, because you and I are sort of familiar with that sort of ecosystem, if you will.
Sure.
Talk a little bit about sort of the responsibilities of SPC and WPC and perhaps how they've evolved over the years.
Well, as you know, that the atmosphere works in many mysterious ways and across many scales, right? So, you know, a thunderstorm is a small scale aspect of the atmosphere, while major storm systems, mid-latitude cyclones, winter storms like we're dealing with this week, Arctic outbreaks, those are larger scale systems. And essentially, the Weather Service has developed a set of centers that are focused on either a scale challenge or a particular forecast challenge. So in this, in the case of the Storm Prediction Center, it's both a scale and phenomenon challenge. You know, focus on severe thunderstorm development, focus on tornado potential, focus on hail, high winds associated with thunderstorms. Develop a cadre of forecasters who are exposed to these forecast challenges day in and day out. And if you can hold on to them long enough, and they will, because these are wonderful places to work, you can really build up expertise at these national centers. So with the Storm Prediction Center, the focus is on severe convection or thunderstorms. Here at the Weather Prediction Center, the focus has been on, for many years, over 40 years, looking at precipitation forecasting, trying to get the forecast right for rainfall, snowfall, and especially more recently, extreme events, extreme rain, extreme winter weather, extreme temperatures. So temperatures, precipitation are our focus here at the Weather Prediction Center. The Aviation Weather Center is located in Kansas City. They're responsible for weather in the air. You know, basically aviation interests are incredibly dependent on accurate forecasting. And so the Aviation Weather Center is focused on that. The Hurricane Center down in Miami, we all know what they do. And they have a staff of exceptional meteorologists whose sole purpose is to get the hurricane forecasts right, and to get the messaging right. So each center has its specialists and expertise grown over the years. And also each center has a research component associated with it that specializes in trying to improve the forecasts through research to operations.
Talking with Greg Carbon, and when we come back, I'm going to ask Greg the big question pretty early in the podcast.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient, comfortable. Ah.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
And we are back on the Weather Geeks podcast. I'm Dr. Marshall Shepard from the University of Georgia, and I'm speaking with my colleague Greg Carbon, the National Weather Service. We're looking back and forward on his career. He's someone that I've actually known and sort of admired from afar from quite a bit of time as someone coming up in this field. You knew the name Greg Carbon, and so it's really an honor to be able to talk to him and sort of pick his brain on how things have changed. And that's where I wanted to go next with my question. What are some of the biggest changes in your illustrious career within the National Weather Service that you have seen over the span of your career, positive or negative?
Sure. Well, there are many. It's hard to know where to start, you know. It's really been, and I'm sure this is the case for other sciences, other endeavors. You know, if you look at medicine or computing, there have been tremendous advances in the technology and the application of that technology to improve improve our lives and improve society. And with meteorology, specifically my experience with meteorology, you know, I started in the days of the fax maps. You know, we would wait for the facsimile maps
There's
to come out.
From the past.
Yeah. And that was the way you received the latest data and information. Interestingly, my career with the National Weather Service coincided with the birth of the internet. And so, you know, using the internet to access data changed everything. And we had an amazing ability all of a sudden to download enormous amounts of data over the internet. At that time, it was, you know, over the modem, but you could utilize the internet, and then watching that grow to the World Wide Web from early technologies. That has to be one of the big remarkable technological changes I've seen. One other aspect that stands out is the change from analog to digital technology when it comes to radar. So when I started, we used analog radar essentially to detect thunderstorm formation, heavy rain or snow or hail. And there were all sorts of techniques you would use on this display. You probably remember the old sweeping displays that you would see on the cathode ray tube. And I remember my first boss had a test where you had to go in. He would go into the radar room, and these were rooms that were darkened so that you could see the screen. So the radar had its own room, and he would go in there and he would mess up all the knobs. He would, you know, and these systems have a lot of knobs, a lot of dials and things that need to be tuned correctly in order for them to work. So his test for any intern coming on is to go in there, mess up the whole console, and then you go in and get it up and running. And so I'm a geek. I love this stuff, right? So
we love it too.
Yeah, I was a ham radio operator and you know, relatively technically savvy. So I said, okay, I'm ready. Went in the room, got it set up, and I came out and I said, it's ready to go. And he looked at me and he said, you couldn't have done it. You couldn't have done it that fast. No, nobody's done it that fast. Like I said, he was a little bit hard-nosed about stuff. Ex-military came in. He went in, looked at it, and he's like, I guess you got it. You passed. You can operate the radar. So those were the analog systems that were used for weather detection. And then the WSR 1988 sounds like a long time ago, but that technology was very advanced at the time, using Doppler concepts to build the radar system that we now have basically across the United States. And to watch this transition from analog to digital, to be involved in it, to go from working the radar in the dark analog radar room and then walking out and operating on the modern digital radar was really just an experience I'll treasure, because you could really see the advances right in your front of your eyes as far as what you could see inside of storms. The information coming out of the Doppler radar was just a remarkable advance. So that's really one of the more memorable experiences in my career.
You know, I'm talking with Greg Carbon, and it's just fascinating to hear some of his perspective. Let me read you some things. In September 2016, you received the Theodore Fujita Research Achievement Award, and the citation read, for your groundbreaking work on severe weather climatology, which has revolutionized the way the meteorological community visualizes and uses severe weather statistics. There was research at the time that you were the WCM at SPC in tornado warning lead times as well. So you mentioned this earlier, that though you're in an operationalized environment at the Weather Service, there's research that's ongoing as well. Tell us how research shaped your career.
So there's always the unknown, and forecasters, operational forecasters, they can only improve if they look at what went wrong, and you don't have to wait around very long to have a poor forecast. You have to either build a thick skin to Mother Nature, or you find another career because there's always uncertainty associated with forecasting. And when it comes to severe weather forecasting, the details are really difficult to pin down with any kind of lead time. So as you're developing your outlook forecasts, or maybe even issuing a severe thunderstorm or tornado watch, that doesn't go well. Now, when we say go well, we mean doesn't necessarily verify with storms as you expected. You go back and you try to figure out, well, what did I see or where did I misinterpret the data to make a decision to go with this? And so constantly, it's a feedback loop. You know, you're trying to improve your understanding of the atmosphere by going back and seeing what actually happened and comparing that with what your assumptions were beforehand. It's classic science, right? It's observations drive your theory, and then you test that theory and see if you can find those observations. The other large, pretty dramatic advances in forecasting have come with ensembles, you know, the ability of computers to run more than one particular model, as well as the advances in the resolution of those models. So you're able to now simulate almost an actual thunderstorm. You know, when we started out in meteorology, you were making grand assumptions about what the model considered a thunderstorm. Model could not generate an ideal, you know, individual thunderstorm. We're now at the point where the simulations look just like what you see on radar, which can be a little dangerous because they can look too real. And you've got to know that that is not the real atmosphere you're looking at. That's a simulation, and it's not going to be perfect. So you have to learn from those simulations where they're good and where they're not so good, where you need to, you know, make certain assumptions and where, you know, you might want to change your forecast based on other information, the environment, the pattern, what's on radar, what's on satellite.
Talking with Greg Carbon, I'm Dr. Marshall Shepard from the University of Georgia. And now in your role at WPC and SPC, and you're about to retire, so maybe I can ask this question and you can give me an answer here and not be worried about the consequences. I know you're still technically employed with NOAA, but what are your thoughts? I mean, there's a lot of discussion now on lead time. Can we ever have too much? I mean, we've made some advances, but I've seen some discussion out there in terms of if we could actually have the science to get us to an hour lead time for a tornado warning. Is that a good thing? What are your thoughts on that discussion?
Well, first, let me answer the point about being open and honest and transparent. I've given a lot of credit to this agency as a scientific agency. I've never had any issue or concern about speaking my mind. I think that, you know, that says a lot for working for NOAA and the National Weather Service. You know, anybody has to be concerned. They're not necessarily speaking for everyone in the agency, but I think the idea that science comes first and that we try to be, you know, be true to the science, regardless of where that may lead us, is something that is supported. I know it's supported by my immediate boss, and it's supported by the agency.
Here, here. I agree.
Yeah. So for lead time, yeah, that's a great question, right? I mean, we talk about. I had a talk yesterday where I was focusing on winter storms. Right now, the traditional thought is that you might want to get a winter storm watch out about 3 days, 3 days in advance of the event. If there's nothing else going on, you know, it gets complicated if there are multiple events like we're seeing this January across the country. But 3 days, it seems like a reasonable time, but the science is now getting to the point where you might actually have the ability to issue a winter storm watch at 4 days or even five, if the confidence is there. That's a real paradigm shift for many forecasters, right? And we're starting to think about, well, what's the benefit of that? And what would you do with that information? And certainly there's more time to prepare. There's not a mad rush at the grocery store at the last minute for people to get their bread and milk.
Run.
Yes, right. So infrastructure could possibly benefit from longer lead time with respect to winter. And that's kind of my focus at this point in my career. Now, if we go back to severe storm forecasting, so the challenge there is how good can you be? You're talking about, with respect to a tornado, right? You're talking about an incredibly small-scale event, although there may be numerous tornadoes over a particular region. What can you do with a significant lead time in those events? Now, and what is significant lead time? Right now, you know, 9 to 13 minutes, I think, is the average warning lead time ahead of a tornado event. And there are a lot of false alarms with those events. And there's a debate about whether false alarm is a meaningful problem. In some areas, it might be. In others, you know, it's so infrequent that, you know, it's in the noise. So I do think that there is a balance between confidence in an event, but also public safety and erring on the side of caution. Dr. Doswell might have called it the inverse penalty function, right? So you might be quite aggressive and warn, even though there's a high probability of a miss or a false alarm, because to not capture the event would be potentially devastating. And so you might lean toward being a little more aggressive in your warning strategy and trying to get out there ahead of something so you don't miss it. But if you miss it, maybe the penalty isn't as high as if or if you don't miss it, you know, so there's a balance. And I'm not sure if I have a good answer for what the ideal lead time is or what you could do with that lead time. I think that's the nature of forecasting going from the large scale, this what we call this facets concept that's been developed, forecasting a continuum of environmental threats. So as you're out far in time, your certainty of an event is quite large, or uncertainty is quite large. As you get closer, it may get the certainty of that event may get greater, and you go from outlook scale to watch scale to warning scale to the event. Now, the problem with that concept is it's not linear. We all know that sometimes between the watch and the warning, there can still be tremendous uncertainty. And so it's important to keep in mind that this is just sort of a conceptual approach to challenging hazardous weather forecasting. It is a good approach, I think, and it makes sense that you give people a heads up in a general sense. And then as you get closer to the event, you're honest, and you have to be honest about what you know and what you don't know. We're still uncertain. This is the general area we expect to see a threat this afternoon. And I know that different municipalities have taken different approaches to using this information. For example, I think in Alabama, that might be a moderate risk day. They call school off, and that may be a wise decision if the schools don't provide, you know, necessarily an adequate shelter. But if the schools are good at providing shelter, it might be better to have school on those days. So these are really challenging, complex societal issues with respect to safety in light of hazardous weather.
Yes, an interesting point, because here in Georgia, where I am, I've seen some school districts close, and there are people on social media, why are we closing school for rain and so forth and so on? But I think you hit it on the head in terms of the different risk calculations for those jurisdictions. Now, when we come back in this last segment, I want to ask Greg about what some of his more memorable weather events that he has covered and get his thoughts on where we're going with AI and weather forecasting when we get back.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey. Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai.
There's joy in every journey.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
And we are back on the Weather Geeks podcast. I'm Dr. Marshall Shepard from the University of Georgia, and I'm speaking with Greg Carbon from the National Weather Service. And by the way, I want to give a shout out to Dr. Chuck Doswell, who you heard Greg mention. For those of you that are old timers with Weather Geeks, I mean, going back to the first television broadcast of the show, you'll recall that Dr. Chuck Doswell was our first ever guest on Weather Geeks. So I think he's someone that Greg and I both admire and look up to, and certainly a pillar in this field. Now, Greg, I you've been at this a while. Are there any particular weather events that sort of stick out in your mind over your career, and for what reason?
Sure. Well, again, going back to Northern New England, probably one of the first major snowstorm events that I remember being as a meteorologist was the storm of the century. In March of 1993. So that storm brought blizzard conditions as far south as the Deep South and, you know, pummeled parts of the Appalachians for many feet of snow, high winds, and high surf all the way up the coast. If I go back even farther than that, it was probably the blizzard of 1978 in New England. But moving into my career, I think I'd have to place the April 2011 tornado outbreak across the South, because that was a point in my career when I was working these events from a communications and also an assessment perspective after the event, trying to account for the damages, trying to account for the number of fatalities. And that April really stands out as a devastating tornado outbreak. And then having responsibility to speak to that event and provide some historic perspective. Another mentor at the time and another personal shout out was Dr. Harold Brooks, sure. Who, you know, Harold and I appeared on your show, I think, together.
Very early in the TV days, for sure.
Right. And Harold and I worked very closely together in terms of assessing the tornado event on April 27th, 2011, tallying the losses of lives and then trying to understand the meteorology. Chuck Doswell, Harold, and I wrote an article for the Royal Meteorological Journal about the entire month of April and how unusually active it was. And those are really memorable and rewarding experiences that I've had in my career.
So I mentioned before the last break, I mentioned things like AI, because certainly we're hearing quite a bit about that across the weather, water, and climate enterprise. As you sort of enter sort of the retirement phase of your career, you are versed in what's going on and where things are going. What are some things that you would like to see change or evolve across the weather enterprise? Particularly in light of things like artificial intelligence, machine learning, the influx of social sciences into what we do. Just where do you see things going forward?
That's a great question. So I'm definitely interested in, I've always been interested in computer science and in utilizing the power of computing to understand the atmosphere, to understand patterns, to put events in perspective. So I've always been a dabbler and a bit of a coder myself, trying to visualize the complex nature of weather and forecasting. So one of my plans of retirement actually is to build my own machine learning code, not really related to meteorology, but I want to understand more about computer vision, about how computers run neural networks and the fascinating and mysterious aspects of those systems and how output, you know, can be a complete surprise from them. So I'm interested in digging in a little deeper on that topic. There have been some pretty remarkable recent advances in applying machine learning and AI And it makes sense. When you think about it, so much of what we do as human forecasters is related to pattern recognition. Yeah. And so you can train an AI basically to generate a forecast based on pattern, based on the current pattern and what will come after that, the current, how the current pattern evolves into a future pattern. So it's not really surprising to see some of the advances being made with respect to AI. What is also quite remarkable is that there's a lot of back-end processing required, right? So our current framework for numerical model modeling and numerical weather prediction, there's a lot of front-end processing. You've got to pull in a number of observations, you have to do quality control, and then you have to run the model out in time on some of the fastest computers in the world. And that they even though they're fast, they still take time to generate simulations of the atmosphere. And in an ensemble system, you're doing that across 100 different models. So there's a real high-end cost to processing the current generation of numerical weather models. In AI, all of that processing is actually done ahead of time, so that all of the inputs are based on past patterns of the atmosphere at really, really high resolution, and you're generating a learning model that has to run through it tests itself, it tests against itself, so it's grading itself, it's throwing out poor solutions and keeping good solutions, and it learns. But that is also computationally intensive. But once it's done, you can apply that concept immediately to the weather forecast. So it's a fascinating aspect of where you put your compute power. Do you put it beforehand, or do you put it up and during the event for every forecast? So there are benefits to both approaches, I think, is what we're seeing. I think that we hold out hope that you could generate ensemble forecasts faster. So that means you could probably generate more of them using an AI machine learning approach. I'm not an expert. I've read a couple papers regarding the application of machine learning to forecasting. It's an absolutely fascinating area that I want to learn more about. And I think it will push the science forward like so many other things have, like Doppler radar, like satellite, like numerical weather prediction, high resolution. AI is just another step. Now, the question is it an exponential growth in terms of our predictability? At the end of the day, we all learn from Ed Lorenz that there is a limit to predictability.
That's correct.
And so even with AI, it's probably not the silver bullet.
Yeah, chaos theory and Ed Lorenz. Now, one question people are concerned about is, will it take the human being out of the process?
Yeah.
Radar didn't do it. Satellites and ensemble models didn't do it. You certainly sound like you believe the AI as a tool, but it doesn't threaten human intervention in the forecast process.
At the end of the day, the analogy that I think is most appropriate here, perhaps, especially when it comes to significantly dangerous weather, is the analogy of the pilot in the cockpit. We've had the technology for planes to fly essentially on their own for decades. Nobody wants to fly in a plane without a pilot. And so I think, for a while, we're gonna want the forecaster to translate the information and provide some level of confidence or uncertainty to decision makers and the general public.
That's a great analogy and a good place to end it. Any final words to our listeners, some of which I know are very aware of you and your career? So as someone who's had such an illustrious career, I want to sort of defer to you for these last few seconds. If you want to share anything, we have a fairly broad listenership.
Well, thanks again, Marshall, for having me today. I'm a little uncertain about what retirement will bring. I think anybody in my position probably would be. I consider myself incredibly lucky to have had the experiences I've had, to be engaged in the science. I am interested in pursuing mentorship for others who are interested in science, and hopefully I can do that even in retirement. I'm never going to lose my fascination for what goes on in the atmosphere. Every day is different. I'll probably go back to a more simple approach, though, and have a little logbook with a max min thermometer and weather station and keep track of local weather. But I'll remain engaged, definitely, and look forward to continued research and understanding of what's going on.
Well, you know, we certainly wish you the best and congratulations on this milestone in your career. And thank you for coming on the Weather Geeks podcast. Again, as you mentioned, you were also on the Weather Geeks television show. Now we're somewhat of a hybrid in that we do a podcast and we air on the Weather Channel streaming app and streaming channels on your smart TV. So be sure to check us out there as well. By the way, Weather Geeks listeners, tweet me and tell me how many and which guests have appeared on the television show as well as the podcast. I'd love to hear your thoughts on that. We know that Greg is one. By the way, Greg, thank you again. I'm Dr. Marshall Shepherd from the University of Georgia. We'll see you next time on Weather Geeks.